Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is my friend and longtime friend, Julian Pleasance, a former resident of Farrington. He was a longtime history professor at the University of Florida, prolific researcher and author of more books about North Carolina maybe than anybody, and North Carolina history and politics. I want to talk to him about his new book, Homefront, North Carolina During World War II. And Julian, you say that World War II changed the whole face of North Carolina dramatically. What do you mean?
Well, if we look at it just in economic terms, the federal government spent $2 billion in the state, which would be $32 billion in today's money. And they built a huge number of forts. If we just look at the building in the state, and because of the building, it made use of our lumber resources, it made use of our very, very competent working force, which was, of course, rather cheap at the time. And they built a huge number of bases, somewhere in the number of 60.
60 bases? 60? I mean, we know about Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune and Seymour Johnson and those big bases, but 60 Army base or 60 armed forces bases?
Well, if you do, for instance, if you look at the Charlotte Quartermaster Airport, if depot, if you look at Raleigh-Durham Airport, if you look at Morris Field in Charlotte, there was
Camp Butner,
Camp Butner. There was a blimp base in Weeksburg. There were Coast Guard. There was a rest and recreation center in Lake Lure, Air Force Training Center in Greensboro, glider base in Laurinburg and Maxton, Camp McCall in Hoffman, Camp Davis, Camp Sutton, on and on and on. Some of them were not major bases, but there were these facilities that were put in the state of North Carolina.
Well, those were just temporary. Most of those were just temporary. That didn't change the face of North Carolina if it was a temporary base, would it?
Well, it did, because if we look at the development of the economy, the salaries, individual salaries in the state, increased 2.5 times during the war. And one of the individuals that I talked to said that he was on a farm and he decided that he didn't want to work for 50 cents a day when he could go work at Fort Bragg for $7.20 a day. And not only could he go to Fort Bragg and make more money, he could learn a skill. And that skill would help him after the war. So that impact, all of that spending, all of the number of people who came into the state trained probably 2 million civilians and troops in the state. So new people coming in, spending impact of the federal government, spending impact of the new residents, changed the state, which had been two-thirds rural. Now it becomes more urban. It becomes much more toward a skilled economy than just a farm economy.
You know, that's really interesting. So that the impact of the war, although the number of dollars spent and the goods and services purchased during the war were not as permanent as the elevation of the skills of the people of North Carolina and their aspirations because of they saw what they could do.
Absolutely. It's a totally new option for people. You know, we're still in the Depression, and people didn't have much in the way of resources. The educational system was not very good. They didn't have the state's 67,000 miles of roads, only a third were paved. And the federal government comes in and they build hospitals and they build training centers, and all of a sudden the emphasis is now more on skilled labor. The people in the state built amazing number of things. They built flamethrowers, they built grenade launchers, barges for the aircraft, batteries, shell plants in Carrboro and Charlotte. In other words, they produced a lot of items over and above the basic products of the state, which, of course, were textiles and tobacco and lumber. And so this is going to expand the economic opportunities, not just for the workers, but for business and investment. And a lot of companies like J.A. Jones Building Company became a nationally renowned company, and they started out building forts and ended up building ships. So that changed
building
the
ships
whole
in North Carolina
context.
In North
yeah.
Carolina?
Yeah.
Well, Julian, help me with this question that I've got. In many cases, as you see boom periods come either in national economies or even in regional economies where the one big business or one big customer comes in or one big oil well or oil production, and then and that spurs up the economy, but then that disappears. And a lot of times there's a bust, and, you know, when the war was over, the government essentially got out of town.
Well, I'll give you a good example. Camp McCall and Hoffman, when they came to Hoffman, Hoffman was a town of about 800, and it ended up being close to 90,000. Today, it's back to about 800. And unless you search out some of the buildings, you would never know Camp McCall was there.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you go to Seymour Johnson or you go to Camp Lejeune or Fort Bragg, they have expanded and have become an essential part of the economy. One little interesting fact I came across was in Holly Ridge, where Camp Davis was, they had 28 people, and in 2 years they had 100,000 people. So they had to build roads, they had to build PXs for the troops, they had to build gyms, basketball courts, on and on and on. They had to build railroads, roads. So the investment, much of that infrastructure remained, although many of the forts, when the war was over, they just closed them up.
Well, what about, and you mentioned some of the manufacturing facilities of these armaments that were made in North Carolina, and we know that there was aircraft being manufactured, I think, in Charlotte and in Greensboro, and maybe other places mm-hmm. as well. That stopped, didn't it? The manufacturer of commercial aviation went someplace else, didn't it? We didn't.
Yeah, and a lot of them did. But again, if you look, let's take textiles. If you look at what happened to, say, Burlington Industries and Cannon Mills and all of those, because of the extraordinary need for all of these products. And you remember, they made just about everything you could think of. The governor said he thought that every soldier and sailor in service either wore or carried some article manufactured in North Carolina. They made shirts and shorts and underwear and socks and gloves. And
well, you didn't mention the towels.
Towels.
Did Charlie Cannon's business get a boost, and did it?
That's right.
Roll over into the post World War II era.
It did. I think it continued to expand. Cannon Mills had a bestseller. They made a towel called "To Hell with Hitler."
Is that right?
They sold a lot of those. But it really changed the state to a large degree from rural to urban. So people were moving to Greensboro and Burlington and some of these towns that are going to expand, like Kannapolis. And there was a really big ammunition plant in Carrboro. And so all of that helped develop the economic base for further expansion into the war. And it also emphasized much more than previously education.
What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, in order to get some of these jobs, you take some of these farmers, they didn't know a rivet from a plow. So they would come and they would get jobs in some of these high-tech industries. And in order to maintain those jobs after the war, they needed to be skilled and educated. And so the state, after the war, is going to spend a huge amount of money improving the educational system so that the state can keep up. They don't want to revert back to a pretty much, it was the old state that was called a Rip Van Winkle state, because they were 45th out of 48 in per capita income prior to that. The average age of education for a white male was 7.9 years, and for a black male was 5.9 years. So that's pretty low. And then in the selective service, of 1940, North Carolina had more rejects than any other state. 45% of all the males who were drafted were rejected for either illiteracy or physical problems, bad teeth, pellagra, TB, whatever. And that's an embarrassing circumstance. So that forced, literally, the state to come to grips with these problems. And we just didn't have a good educational system, didn't have any decent hospitals. And so the state realized that they're going to have to spend money and commit to these issues if the state was going to ever be progressive.
Well, we're visiting, or I'm visiting with my friend Julian Pleasance. We're talking about his new book, which is called Home Front, North Carolina During World War II. And if you're interested in that book, we'll have some information on our webpage about how you can order it directly from the publisher. If you don't find that you can publish it, of course, on Amazon and in some bookstores. So, Julian Pleasance, I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Julian Pleasance, and we're talking about his new book, Homefront, North Carolina During World War II. And Julian, thank you for joining us and being willing to share some of the book. I find, particularly in my generation, that there is real sort of warm feelings about World War II and memories, not so much of what we remember ourselves as much as what we've heard our parents talking about in terms of both the disruption and of life during World War II in North Carolina, some of the tough things that happened, and then just these memories of this was a very special time. Life, people will say, you know, life got better for us. We lost friends and family members in the fighting, and that was terrible. But looking back at it, North Carolina is better because of some of the things that happened. And you got it all cataloged in your book. You talked about some of the economic things that happened in our first segment. And we were moving sort of into education. And I worried about the universities because when the war started, the student body population depleted as people were drafted or volunteered to go in the services. Some of the universities were in trouble. How did the war impact the education system and the particularly the colleges and universities?
Yeah, well, I wanted to mention that 7,000 Tar Heels died during the war, so that was always a difficult process of trying to get one of those telegrams the State Department regrets to
the Gold Star, Gold Star moms, the Gold Star families.
Yeah, exactly. You went from a blue star demonstrating that you had a family member in service, and then if they died, the Gold Star was in the window. The essence of what happened during the war is that young men went off to fight. Same thing with the farms. You know, they went off to go to war, and there were not as many people available to get in the crops. But at the University of North Carolina in particular, that school probably would have had to close down had they not gotten a federal grant to organize and take up training of Navy pilots. So they're going to end up with a class of about 1,800 who would go through about 2 months training, and then another class of 1,800 would come in. And so they had to build new facilities. They had to expand the eating facilities. They had to build more exercise facilities. They had to develop new courses, and they were working with the University of North Carolina faculty. Faculty took care of the academics. The Navy took care of the training. And it turned out to be a great benefit to the university because they were able to stay open. They were actually able to make money. And all the facilities that the Navy built, when the Navy left, they turned those over to the university. So it was good for the community, Chapel Hill, because one of the things that I remember is the people who were shining shoes made a fortune.
like haircuts
and shoes were a big item in a small town like Chapel Hill. And so if we look at another school like Davidson, Davidson would have probably had to close its doors had it not taken in training Air Force students. And so North Carolina State did some, almost every school, Duke did, almost every school in the state was able to keep the doors open because they were able to sponsor a federally organized program to train not just soldiers, but sometimes dentists, sometimes lawyers, all sorts of training that were necessary to win the war. It took place at these universities. Some of them trained waves and wax. So there was all kind of federal intervention, as it were, in the state university system. And it makes sense.
Well, then
why should the Navy have to build a whole new facility when they could go to a campus like Chapel Hill and the dorms were already there and the facilities were in place?
Yeah, but, Julian, then when the war ended, all of that went away. I mean, so how did the universities, they first lost their people to the who signed up for the armed services, and then they survived by training, doing various training exercises and projects for the defense of the country, and then the war was over. What happened then?
Then came the GI Bill.
Oh, okay.
And the most important decision in many ways the federal government's ever made, certainly one of the best returns on an investment. And so all of these veterans come to Chapel Hill and live in Victory Village, and they're intent on getting an education immediately. They have to live in sort of Quonset huts and that sort of thing, but they work hard and they get ahead. And suddenly the campuses are exploding. They don't have enough facilities now to take care of all the veterans who are coming back, plus the students who would regularly be enrolled. So that was a huge impact on education in the state.
Do you think that in general, that as a result of the war, that that there were more university, college and university graduates or educated ready to go in the workforce than there were before the war? I mean, was this a dramatic increase?
Absolutely.
And was it just because of the GI Bill?
Some of it. I think because the economy was so much better and because some of these rural people had now moved into the cities and had a different environment, different relationships, they now saw themselves as having opportunities that they wouldn't have had previously. So kids who grew up in a small town in the state might not ever think about going to college. But now, and partly because the state expended more money on schools, particularly at the beginning level, grammar schools, these kids were able to get a better education. And again, remember, before the war, 7.9 was the years of education for a white male. That's the average. So after the war, more and more kids are going through high school. And once they get through high school, then they have the opportunity to go on the state university. And the universities are very reasonably priced at this time.
There was another dimension that I'm not sure how you can describe it, but I call it sort of the Bill Friday, Bill Aycock effect. And that is talented people, these guys had already gone to college, but they came back and went to law school. But when they came back, they had this incredible experience in leading people, solving problems, working at high levels with different kinds of people, and that we try to put our finger on the greatest generation and why it was, but it sure paid off in North Carolina if it's for no other reason than Chancellor Aycock and President Friday came back ready to lead.
Absolutely. And then in 1948, Carr Scott was elected. He was a progressive governor. And he took some of the surplus from the war and was able to spend the money on roads and hospitals and better schools. And so they had a real progressive development during this period of time. And the catalyst was the war. It's hard to imagine how this state would have changed without that investment by the federal government in the state. And just think about the number of people. The state during 40 to 50 gained 500,000 people. And a lot of these were people who came down here from New York and California to be trained, and a lot of them stayed. And so the state now is exposed to different views, different attitudes, different parts of the country. One guy I interviewed said, after 1945, said he'd never seen a Catholic before. Which sounds a little strange, but if you look at the population of 3.5 million, 16,000 were foreign-born. That's all.
Well.
So this was a very white, although a quarter of the population was black, but the leadership was very white and generally rural. And so all of this is going to change so dramatically. And once the Depression is essentially over, then the state has enough resources that it can expand when the war ends.
Julian, you point out that North Carolina went from being the Rip Van Winkle state, that is a state that was asleep and far behind everybody else, to being at the end of the war and immediately after the war to being more and more a leader, at least in the region. But all the other southern states, or many of the other states, also had booming times because of the war economy and had bases that were established in there. Did they do like North Carolina and jump leap ahead, or did North Carolina do a little bit better than the, or a lot better
North
than
Carolina, yeah, North Carolina did a little bit. Georgia, of course, did extremely well. Atlanta, and they had a lot of bases in Georgia. South Carolina, of course, Jackson and several bases. But a lot of the states like Louisiana and others, Fort Polk and places like that, didn't expand quite as much. North Carolina had, people don't realize it, had a pretty strong base in furniture and textiles and tobacco. Now, those are not what we think of today as very extraordinary productivity lines, but nonetheless, they were important for the state. And in terms of opportunity and people having jobs, it was very, very important. In fact, we were the largest producer of mica in World War II, which was an important item. And so the state is stronger as it comes out of the war than, say, South Carolina. But Georgia developed quite a bit. And, of course, Florida developed hugely. They had a lot of military bases down there. And Florida.
Yeah.
People wanted to go south. So, well, one of the things I wanted to talk about that
Let's take a break, and then can we come back to that?
Yep.
We need to take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Julian Pleasance, who's the author of Homefront, North Carolina During World War II. We're talking about some of the things that he covers in his book, but it is an incredibly comprehensive book that you will enjoy reading. And we're going to put on our webpage a way that you can get it for a price that's less than the pretty high price that the University of Florida Press has put on it. And Julian Pleasance, and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with my friend Julian Pleasance, who is who's a great historian, great researcher, written so many books about North Carolina. And the latest one is Homefront, North Carolina During World War II. And we're talking about some of the things that he points out in his book that are the reasons that he argues that World War II just transformed North Carolina primarily for the better. And we're mentioning a few of those. And Julian, let's continue our conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that I knew very little about when I started researching, and I had thought that I had covered women in the war throughout the book, and I realized I had not done them justice, so I added another chapter, which turned out to be the largest chapter in the book, and we could not have won that war, obviously, without women.
Why? And they didn't do any fighting, did they?
Some of them did, actually. Mm-hmm. Some of the nurses ended up in combat zones. And had to end up defending themselves. And there were quite a few who joined the various branches of government, and there were quite a few who joined the military, you know, the WACs and the WAVES and all of that. So the thing that intrigued me was the shift of women from just being homemakers to being skilled workers. Now, the great majority of women stayed as homemakers, or they continued to teach school, or they were clerks, or they were stenographers, whatever. They continued to stay in basically what were then described as female jobs, but a lot of them began to develop opportunities in skilled labor. For example, in the Douglas Aircraft Plant, women were 45% of the workforce. In the Boeing plant, 47% of the employees.
These are in North Carolina.
These were not in North Carolina.
I got you. Okay, good. So these are
overview, but in North Carolina, for example, in Charlotte, they had a Shell plant, and 21,000 workers in the Shell plant, overwhelming number were women. And they were hired with the understanding that they were to do a man's job, be treated the same as men, paid the same as men, although that didn't always prove to be the case, and that they were to be integrated in the workforce with the same training. When they took those jobs at the Shell plant in Charlotte, they got safety and medical facilities. They had all sorts of extra incentives. They had cafeterias, lockers, showers, bus facilities to take them to work, insurance, all of the child care, everything. So suddenly, these women were in jobs that were almost always limited to men. They came in doing these jobs. They did better than the men. They didn't come in Monday hungover. They didn't tend to get in any fights. They were effective and skilled at their job. Some of them were particularly good at manufacturing shells. They had smaller hands that would fit. They were more reliable. As one guy who employed women said, and this is no surprise to anybody, they use their brains more efficiently than men. So we knew that in terms of what they contributed, they made almost every product you can think of. They made tanks. They did every kind of work. And for the first time, I think men began to respect women and what they could do. Sometimes when they went in the service, one commander at Camp Lejeune, where they had actually women Marines, I didn't even know that, he told them to go home and knit socks. But it turned out they were as good or better than anybody in the male group. And so this is a change. This is a barrier that is broken down, and the women could see themselves in terms of their potential. The bad news was, at the end of the war, they all lost their jobs, and now all the jobs were, quote, reserved for veterans. They had the first priority. But women had had a chance, and they had achieved, and that they wanted to have more opportunities, and they liked the competition. They liked the travel. And that's something that completely changed the attitude toward women, not only in North Carolina, but all over the country.
Well, you think about it, and the war demonstrated how much more unutilized protective capacity there was, and even it's taken now 75 years, I guess, to be able to say that we have pretty much achieved equality in the workforce. People might argue with that, but in any event, we've dramatically increased the productive power of the United States workforce by taking advantage of the women's talent and good work habits and creativeness. And you may not have happened if it hadn't been for World War II, is your argument.
Yeah, the bad news, in a way, is had they utilized African-Americans and women to their fullest capacity, we might have won the war sooner. Hard to know something like that, but they were underutilized. And one of the great little stories that came out, you know Rosie the Riveter, but you don't know about Edith the Welder at the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company.
Tell us about Edith the Welder. Tell us about her.
Two women became the first women to pass the welder's test. for the longest time, they wouldn't even let them take the test. So they passed it and went to work, and they were, again, absolutely as good as the men. And many of the men grudgingly said, well, gee, you know, these guys are, these women are really good, and we respect them, and we're glad to have them working with us. And the other aspect is that the women contributed in a thousand ways, nursing, Red Cross, all of the things that volunteers do during wartime, buying bonds, victory gardens, picking up scrap, all of that. The women held the country together while the men were out fighting.
Well, we're visited with Julian Pleasants, our friend formerly from Farrington, who is the author of a brand new book called Homefront, North Carolina During World War II, and we're talking about, we'll continue our conversation about it after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Julian Pleasants. We're talking about his new book, Homefront, North Carolina During World War II. Julian, we've been talking about some of the aspects. Golly, we're close to being out of time and haven't covered the waterfront at all. But you've got some other topics. A lot of people wonder about the North Carolina coast. They've heard there was something going on over on the North Carolina coast during World War II, and you know, we didn't really have we didn't have the war on our in the continental United States. We didn't have bombing attacks like the British did or anything like that, except over there on the North Carolina coast. And what was going on over there?
Well, it's really amazing. A month after December 7th, 1941, German submarines began sinking merchant vessels off the coast of North Carolina, all over the eastern coast. But some 80 vessels were sunk off the coast of North Carolina from January to July 1942. And the people at Ocracoke and other places were astonished to see these oil tankers blazing 5 miles off the coast where they had been sunk by these German U-boats. And they had come all the way from Germany and were able to spend about 5 to 8 days because of the fuel limitations before they went back to Germany. And they were absolutely overwhelming in terms of destroying the American merchant marines. And well, not American, I'm sorry, most of them were foreign ships. But they were effective. It was called the Great Atlantic Turkey Shoot, Torpedo Junction, off the coast of North Carolina. The German U-boat captains kept talking about the fact that these ships were sitting ducks. They were silhouetted against the lights on the coast, and the German subs would stay on the bottom during the day, come up at night, and just blow them out of the water. And it was incredibly important because these were the absolutely essential supplies to Britain and our allies in order to survive the war. And we're just getting into the war, so we're not at the point where we're going to be great help militarily, but we were able to get supplies. And if the Germans could cut off our supply in the North Atlantic, it would have been a vital part of the war.
Well, why didn't they attack them in the North Atlantic rather than, you know, this far away from the German homeland? Why didn't they catch them after they, you know, when they were halfway across the Atlantic, by, you know, isolated and by themselves?
There are two reasons for that. In the Atlantic, by that time, the tide was starting to turn. The Allies and the Brits were using convoys, which was much more effectively dealing with the submarines. And the other thing was Bletchley Park was able to decipher the German code, Enigma, and they could predict where these subs were. That was not the case off of North Carolina, where they really had no support. I think there were 3 or 4 destroyers and a few blimps and some local boats that were out looking for submarines, and it just was not very effective. And finally, after all these losses, the Navy decided that they would use the convoy system.
And is that what broke it up? Was the convoy system, or did the Germans give up, or what happened?
Well, it was mainly the convoy system, because the Germans would have stayed as long as they were successful. And by the end of the war, I think off the coast of North Carolina, they'd sunk about four subs. Well, and so once they started sinking subs, and once they were able to protect the merchant ships with this convoy system, previously they didn't have enough destroyers. So as they build more destroyers and send them back to this area, then they become effective. And Dönitz, who was the admiral of the German subs, realized that they were not doing an effective job as they had done previously.
I would have thought that if you get that the convoy system would work to the advantage of the subs, because you'd have them all massed together, and you just pick out, you know, you're talking about a turkey shoot. You've got all your turkeys lined up together.
Well, but remember that the outside were all destroyers, and they had depth charges, and they had 50-caliber machine guns, and by the end of, by June, July, they were starting to get some effective way of determining where the subs were.
Uh-huh.
And they had more people searching for them. And once they could spot them, the sub would have to sink, get out of sight. And when they were out of sight during the day, they couldn't function.
Well, Julian,
so eventually they turned the tide, and the Germans had lost too many subs, so they went home.
There are all these stories about, the Germans really were. They were just a few miles off the coast, and there are these stories that maybe some of the Germans would come into town and go to the movies.
Well, it was like often happens. I mean, when you think about it, there were 10,000 German POWs. So you got Germans picking cotton in North Carolina. You got Germans sinking ships right off the coast. So people panicked. And one of the circumstances was in Ocracoke, they discovered, or in Morehead City, that there had been German newspapers left in the movie theater. There was a rumor in Ocracoke that a woman with a German name was refilling the U-boats from her dock, which was a little problematic since her dock was in 4 feet of water. But anybody with a German background who was different, who was suspicious, was run out. And they literally panicked at the fear that somehow the Germans were going to take over Ocracoke.
Well,
and
speaking
that sort of fear is, you know,
I know how it
once
spreads.
It starts.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
it spreads very, very
well,
quickly.
You
there's no
the,
way to stop it.
You mentioned the German POWs. Did we have German prisoners of war in substantial numbers here in North Carolina?
There were 10,000 German POWs. There were 18 separate camps. There were 3,000 Italians in the state, and it turned out to be a rather good system, because the German POWs are obviously much happier to be here than in Berlin. We adhered, unlike the enemy, with the Geneva Convention, so they had very good care and good food and good living conditions, and they didn't have to work too hard. But they worked to a large degree with private contractors. So the contractor would, in effect, hire German POWs from the government and pay the salaries to the government. And the federal government would guard them while they were picking cotton, or while they were doing peanuts, or working in tobacco or textiles, whatever they did. And they were very good, very efficient workers. Almost all the people who employed them said they hated the Nazis, but they really did like the workers and thought they were quite good at what they did. So it was good for the economy. In 1944, I think the federal government made something like $22 million off of just these contracts with private contractors.
Well, did the Geneva Convention permit you to just enslave these people and put them to work and take the benefit of their work and put it in the treasury?
They did. The Geneva Convention said officers did not have to work, non-coms did not have to work, but the regular soldiers did. If they were given the same food, same clothing, same medical care as American soldiers. And they had to have not only that, but they had to have some educational facilities, books in German, They had a soccer field. They had all these other things that were part of the Geneva Convention. And each of the POW camps had their own hierarchy. So they were able to more or less control the group in cooperation with the U.S. military. And in the state of North Carolina, with all those 10,000, only 29 escapes. And of those 29, only one was successful. And that guy was stayed out until 1959 when he finally gave himself
up. Is that right? Where did he go? Do you remember?
He went to Chicago. It was funny. They didn't have any money. They could only get script. And so if you didn't have any language, you didn't have any money, it was hard to escape. But he had friends in Chicago, and he spoke English, and they had smuggled him some money. So he was able to get on the train, go to Chicago, and change his name, and he worked until finally in 1959 it just caught up with him, and he just said, I can't live with this anymore, and he turned himself in. And of course, by that time, nobody really cared.
Nobody cared. And well, listen, you make us care again about World War II and teach us more about our wonderful state and why it's so good in your book about what the experience in North Carolina was in World War II, in your book Homefront. And Julian, if people are interested in securing the book, we'll have some directions on our website about how they can get it, or by ordering it directly from the University of Florida Press and our University Press of Florida. And it's pretty expensive, but you can get it on Amazon, and maybe some of the local bookstores will have it. But it's an expensive book, but it's well worth it. Well worth every penny. And thank you for writing it.
Our guest, thank you, did you?
Thank you. Our guest has been Julian Pleasants. Thanks to him, and thanks to all of you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.